This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What Ben Bernanke said when he went to Capitol Hill today. Why Rupert Murdoch said no deal. And our China series, The 5-Year Plan, continues. What can be bad about a good economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the internet. Reputation.com. For a unique look at all of our Marketplace business and economic sustainability coverage, visit Marketplace.org and click on the Sustainability tab.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 13th of July today, and let's take a minute as we get started to think about the top-level cast of characters who get to help run the American economy. You've got the president and the executive branch. You've got Congress and the power of the purse. You've got the courts in certain instances, and you got a bald guy with a beard. Given the current state of political debate in Washington and the slow pace of the courts, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, is the person who can actually do something about what's happening to get the economy better. The Fed's been pulling back of late, as you might know, but in congressional testimony today, Bernanke said if things get worse, he could step up again. The markets, of course, cheered, as markets are wont to do, but should the rest of us? Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore reports.
Just when Ben Bernanke thought he was out of the stimulus business, the economy may pull him back in. In June, the Fed chairman wrapped up an 8-month buying spree of Treasury bonds to keep interest rates low. The markets cheered that intervention, but the economy barely budged. So today, Bernanke told Congress that if the economy gets worse, then the Federal Reserve maybe, sort of, possibly, potentially, could consider another stimulus. But wait, do you hear that empty click?
The Fed is running out of ammunition.
Ward McCarthy is the chief financial strategist for Jefferies. He noted that the Fed lowered interest rates nearly to zero, lent money cheaply to banks, and bought a lot of mortgages. In the future, Bernanke's options include prodding banks to lend by paying them less to keep their money at the Fed. But will that work? Peter Buchvar, an equity strategist with Miller Tabak, is skeptical.
Interest rates are ridiculously low to begin with.
The benefits are hard to predict. The drawbacks are obvious. The Fed stimulus made life more expensive for the rest of us, says Quincy Crosby. She's a market strategist for Prudential.
It raised the prices for American citizens, for the price of oil at the pump, for heating our homes, and it also raised the price of food. That was the collateral damage.
In Congress today, Bernanke said he believes inflation will pass and that the economy will recover. That would put a going out of business sign on the stimulus. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Mr. Bernanke was the guest of the Financial Services Committee this morning with more than 50 members. It's one of the biggest committees in the House of Representatives, and you never know what they're going to ask. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story from Washington.
During most of Bernanke's 2.5 hours before the committee, he looked like he was watching a tennis match. His head bounced back and forth as he fielded questions from Republicans sitting on his right, appropriately, and Democrats on his left, each side intent on getting a Fed endorsement of their particular brand of politics. For example, Texas Republican Ron Paul tried to persuade the Fed chairman to put the nation's currency back on the gold standard.
Do you think gold is money?
No. You know, it's an asset. I mean, it's the same. Would you say treasury bills are money? I don't think they're money either, but they're a financial asset.
Why do central banks hold it?
Well, it's a form of reserves.
Why don't they hold diamonds?
Well, it's tradition.
You know, some people still think it's money. I yield back. My time is up.
Thank you.
Having dealt with the diamond standard, Bernanke turned to Michigan Democrat Gary Peters, who wanted the chairman to weigh in on an issue that has nothing to do with the business of the Federal Reserve.
Would you comment a little bit about a balanced budget amendment, and are you concerned about that for the future?
Well, I just would like to say that it would be very important to make it sufficiently flexible to deal with different contingencies.
Questions like these pose a challenge for a central banker trying to stay above politics. Former Fed member Lawrence Meyer, now with Macroeconomic Advisers, says on average fewer than 15% of the questions to the Fed chairman during these hearings have to do with monetary policy.
The purpose of these hearings is to give each member of the committee an opportunity to try to get a soundbite out of the chairman that they can go back and use to support whatever their position is that they're taking.
Meyer says all the chairman should do is not take the bait. He should stay calm and answer like the professor he used to be. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you have ideas about what's best for the economy, you can test what they might do to the federal budget by playing our budget hero game. The game is updated with the latest budget numbers and political positions as well. You can find it at marketplace.org. That's our website. Wall Street, we've already mentioned, it's going to be the happy music when we get there. I know they say you can't go back, but that doesn't mean you can't try. So here we go. We came up these stairs around the corner of the Industrial Bank of China and went down the street. While we were in China last month, we retraced our steps from 5 years ago. Flower market's off to the left. We tried to find the place that we broadcast from in 2006. We'd come down here and walk down this hill. God, this is a gray and dismal and gloomy city. The World Trade Center in Chongqing. It was the tallest building in town by far back then. Helpful, since the time difference between here and the U.S. meant we were going to work at 2 in the morning local time.
Is this Howard Johnson's new?
Chongqing has changed quite a bit since 2006. There is more high-end retail, more of a resemblance to Shanghai.
This is new. And here's a Starbucks, which we could have used. And then down here, right, Deb? There's enough stuff that's new. There's a decent amount of new buildings. The question, though, is anybody in those buildings, because we would come here at 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and if you press the wrong button on the elevator and get off at the 40th floor instead of the 45th or whatever it was that we were going up to, there was nothing. It was bare concrete flooring. It was wires dangling from the ceiling. There was nothing. This was a brand new building in 2006, and it looks like it's been here for 35 years. It's just old and covered in grime, and you have to wonder how anything survives here.
I climb in the elevator, punch the buttons for a couple of random floors. 44th floor. Now here you go. See, this is great. This is exactly it. There is nothing here. I have just come out of the elevator. Opens onto a dusty concrete floor. I'll just go give you a sound of the room here. I mean, there's nothing. It is. Here's the dust on the floor. It's crazy. I don't know if you can hear that, but it's there is nothing here. Not only is there nothing but dust, when I go back to head down, there aren't any elevator call buttons either, just dangling wires. Oh, shit. Now I'm going down 34 floors on the stairs. Oh, son of a bitch. Oh, man. Wow. Wow, that was a little scary. Okay. I got out, obviously, but that brief moment of panic didn't make me think. We spent a lot of time in the United States worrying about China and just when they're going to take over the world. Maybe, though, there are other things to worry about. Small things like elevator call buttons, and big things like where China goes from here. Or, as longtime China businessman Kent Kettle puts it,
Deng Xiaoping said, development in China is going to be like crossing the river by feeling for stones. And that's what it is here. There is no bridge.
This is a country with all kinds of challenges to navigate on its way to prosperity. And that is our China story today. How to get there from here. Don't know if you've been keeping track, but we're now, what, 9-something minutes into the program, and the words debt limit have not yet been uttered. So Needless to say, nothing new on that front. Politicians and pundits have been saying for weeks now that the debt limit debate is a real test of leadership for Congress and the president. Commentator Robert Reich says they're failing an even more important test.
The job recession shows no sign of ending. This isn't a temporary jobless recovery. It can no longer be blamed on supply disruptions from Japan, Europe's debt crisis, high oil prices, or bad weather. No, this is something else, and it's going to be with us for years unless Washington wakes up. We're in a vicious cycle in which consumers won't buy more because they're scared of losing their jobs and their pay is dropping. And businesses won't hire because they don't have enough customers. Washington, meanwhile, is playing a game of chicken over raising the debt ceiling, from which will emerge a stopgap measure putting off most long-term budget decisions until after the election. But no one, from the president on down, is coming up with a plan to get Americans back to work, and the lack of leadership is appalling. It's not for lack of ideas. Exempting the first $20,000 of income from payroll taxes for the next 2 years, to put more cash in people's pockets, for example. Recreating the WPA and Civilian Conservation Corps to put the long-term unemployed to work. Enlarging the earned income tax credit so lower-income Americans have more purchasing power. And allowing people who have lost part-time jobs to get partial unemployment benefits so they, too, can buy. What's lacking in Washington isn't ideas, it's political courage. The president doesn't think he can get a jobs plan through a fiercely partisan Congress, so he doesn't try. But that's no excuse. Average Americans are hurting, and the pain is not going away. The president needs to fight for their jobs and their wages. The battle over the deficit is a distraction from this far more important battle. He needs to explain to Americans what must be done and put the burden on his opponents to explain why doing nothing is preferable.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Our future includes David Frum in this space next week. Until then, tell us what you think. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Coming up, China's booming economy means companies aren't choosing workers. The workers are choosing them.
Before, we set some requirement, like they have to be a high school graduate or they have to be under 30. But now we hire people with over 40, over 50.
Our series, The 5-Year Plan, continues straight ahead. But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. Ben Bernanke's star turn on the Hill gave the markets a lift today and reversed a 3-day losing streak, the chairman did. Dow Industrials popped up 44 points, about a third of 1%, ended at 12,491. The NASDAQ nudged up 15 points, a half percent, 2796, the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 hopped up 4 points, a third of 1%, finished at 1318. Mining and materials companies did much of the spade work lifting the markets today. BHP Billiton and Freeport McMoRan both unearthed a nearly 2% gain. Rio Tinto dug up more than 1%. The stuff those guys get out of the ground did well today, too. Gold hit a new record, $1,585 an ounce. And no, that is not inflation-adjusted. We know that. Oil companies were on a tear, too. BP, Chevron, and Exxon all spouted more than a half percent. Schlumberger seeped up nearly 0.2% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.88%. Look out below. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. By Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. And by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department issues its monthly retail sales report. The Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for June. And the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry discusses creating jobs in rural America. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Rupert Murdoch didn't get to be a billionaire by walking away from a fight, but today the head of News Corp did just that. He bowed to immense political pressure and abandoned one of the biggest deals of his career, a plan to buy full ownership of the UK's biggest television network, Sky B. Our man in London, Stephen Beard, has that story.
For 40 years, Murdoch ran rings around British politicians and regulators. With 40% of the British press, he was courted and feared. Today, that spell was finally broken. Murdoch dropped his bid for Sky B. Ed Miliband, leader of Britain's opposition Labour Party.
This is a victory for people up and down this country who have been appalled by the revelations about phone hacking, who have thought it's beyond belief that Mr. Murdoch could, when this criminal investigation is going on, expand his stake in the British media.
Murdoch was desperate to buy the 61% of Sky B that he doesn't already own. His newspaper revenues are declining, but the TV station is churning out cash. To get his hands on that profit, he needs full ownership of the company. Today's decision is a bitter blow, but analyst Ivor Gaber thinks Murdoch may yet bounce back.
Never underestimate Rupert Murdoch. He's a brilliant businessman, resourceful, imaginative, and he's showed himself in the past to have the ability to outwit most.
But Murdoch could be ousted as CEO. News Corp's share price has fallen 20% due to this crisis. American shareholders are grumbling. Media analyst Roy Greenslade, himself a former tabloid editor, does not believe Murdoch will recover.
He's 80 years old. If he was a young, vigorous man, he might be able to get back on track. But I think he's damaged goods, and it's really difficult to believe that the damage can be undone.
Everything now depends on what happens in the US, where he has his most valuable assets. A Democratic senator has called for an inquiry into possible phone hacking in America, and whether News Corp snooped on the families of the victims of 9/11. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in media conglomerate news today, Electronic Arts, the video game giant, is going to spend more than $1 billion to buy an outfit up in Seattle called PopCap. They make what are called casual online games, which is to say stuff for your mobile phone and PC that doesn't necessarily need a terminal. Bejeweled and Plants vs. Zombies are sample titles you might know, or you might not. But here's the thing. Last year, PopCap had $100 million in revenue. So why is EA paying 10 times that much? Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Electronic Arts made a fortune selling games for the Xbox and PlayStation, games like Madden Football and Battlefield. But John Davidson, VP at GameSpot, says EA can't grow if it focuses only on hardcore gamers, the ones willing to pay $50 or $60 a game. He says the company needs to reach hundreds of millions of casual gamers playing on Facebook and their phones instead. And that's where PopCap comes in. PopCap created hits like Bejeweled, Peggle, and Plants vs. Zombies.
Beyond that, they have Bookworm, which, you know, even my mother-in-law plays. I think it's the only game she's ever played, but it's huge for her.
And small, cheap, even free games are huge for the industry now, too. Michael Pachter's a video game analyst at Webbush Securities. He says Zynga, the maker of Farmville and Empire and Allies, has turned the video game business upside down. It gives its games away for free and has attracted hundreds of millions of users who spend hours playing Zynga's games.
So Zynga's got 2 billion minutes a day. I can't even tell you how many hours a year that is, but it's billions and billions and billions. You know, so 2 billion minutes a day of engagement. And the idea is if you have that many billions of, you know, page views, you can sell those people stuff. You can sell them advertising. You can sell them virtual items.
EA thinks it can do the same thing with PopCap. In the meantime, Zynga's planning to go public.
And the market is talking about paying $10 to $20 billion.
Not so long ago, EA was worth that kind of money too, but not anymore. And executives there are betting that PopCap will get them back in the game. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Our series this week, The 5-Year Plan, takes us to China and the live broadcasts we did from there in 2006. We went back last month to see what's changed for them and for us.
The real estate bubble is going to bust.
It's a game of dodgeball. Stay standing.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations.
China's part Africa and part Switzerland.
Just walking around China, it's kind of easy to forget about the whole communist thing. The capitalism here is in your face, to say the least, which is why it's no small irony that literally around the corner from one of the ritziest and most Western-style shopping centers in Shanghai is the first headquarters of the Chinese Communist Party, with tourists, Chinese tourists, lining up to get in. Our guide, analyst Jim McGregor, explained as we talked on a rainy day.
This is where the Communist Party had its first meeting. But this developer from Hong Kong came in. He realized, I'm going to capitalize on this, and he built this exotic shopping center playing on the old Shanghai theme. And look around. This is, I mean, there's foreigners, I think, who live in Shanghai who never make it much more than six blocks away from this place.
If Mao Zedong shows up here today in the middle of Xintiandi, what does he say to himself?
This isn't the kind of party he was thinking of.
The Chinese Communist Party is doing pretty well for itself, even if Chairman Mao wouldn't recognize it. Economic prosperity does go a long way toward political stability. But that prosperity brings with it a problem. How can the government keep meeting rising expectations when a lot of people only know economic growth of 10% a year? Searching for the answer to that question explains how we found ourselves on a Tuesday in Chongqing out in Sichuan Province at a job fair. Three times a week, the local branch office of the Labor Ministry runs what's best described as a speed dating service for jobs. 23-year-old Ju Yin is on her third trip to the job market. She looked at me kind of funny when I asked her why she kept coming back. And then she said, because this is where the jobs are. There are posters plastered all over the walls, want ads, basically. Job title, salary, qualification. Then you head upstairs, and if they like me and I like them, she says, we interview. And if they don't like you, I ask, then I look at other jobs, she says. No big deal. Upstairs, Yuan Yan is having no luck recruiting new hires. No applicants at all today, she says.
Okay, 今天早上有人来吗?
Too many companies looking for people.
感觉不怎么好找。
30 miles outside town, at the Xiangling Auto Parts Factory, we found the exact same thing. The place is an OSHA inspector's nightmare. And while spending 6 days a week in front of a metal grinding wheel isn't our idea of a great job, it's actually a big step up for 23-year-old Duan Yihua. He was working down south in Guangdong in an electronics plant. Came back to Chongqing this spring for a 50% raise. He's making about $500 a month here. The hours are regular, 8 to 5:30. One whole day off every 2 weeks. And plant manager Guo Jingyong says he is still scrambling to find people.
We don't have too many choices. They choose us.
Now, they'll take anybody.
Before, we set some requirement, like they have to be a high school graduate or they have to be under 30. But now we hire people with over 40, over 50. The oldest worker here are over 60.
Most of the workers are serial job hoppers. They're looking for better hours, more money, or both. The government getting people off farms and into factories, making more money, is objectively a good thing. But at the same time, having better lives has made a lot of Chinese a whole lot pickier about how they want to spend their time.
I'll have the Manila clams.
100% for us in 5 years. Salary increase.
We met Scott Minoy when we were in China 5 years ago. Back then, his restaurant chain, Element Fresh, was just a single store catering to Westerners looking for something familiar to eat. Now, sitting in his 10th location smack in the middle of Shanghai, he shares the exact same frustrations as Mr. Guo, the plant manager, back in Chongqing.
There's a lot of employees that just simply don't want to work in this industry. A lot of the countryside people that are moving into Shanghai, they also have grand dreams of being a CEO one day. And they come in and they're like, what? You mean I have to start out at the bottom?
Minoy tries to keep up. He tells people they'll get regular raises,
time and a half overtime, all kinds of perks relatively foreign to Chinese places of employment. But it just doesn't seem to matter.
You know, people don't think about their future as much. They think about, well, if I go take the job across the street and it pays me 200 RMB more, I can save up for that iPhone just that much quicker. Everybody here has become so much, they're growing more and more materialistic pretty quick. And that's what's driving a lot of the consumption as well.
So here's the ultimate challenge. For a country that built its economic engine on the idea that it's cheaper for companies to set up shop here, what happens when it's not? What happens when wages go up because workers can be choosers? The government has a tricky time ahead, lifting people out of poverty, keeping foreign companies here, and making sure more people prosper. Again, Jim McGregor.
The only way the Communist Party survives as a leader here is bringing that next billion into the middle class. I don't think people are here are going to settle for a rich elite and a repressed lower class.
It's that economic prosperity brings political stability thing, which is our China theme for tomorrow, the broad middle ground of the Chinese middle class. We were taking pictures and shooting video the whole time we were over there. You can check them out and hear the other stories in our series, The 5-Year Plan, on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. By IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at IBM.com/engines. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, an apropos statistical follow-up to our China theme on this Wednesday, the problems unrestrained growth can present. The Chinese government announced today that the economy there slowed just a hair last quarter, all the way down to 9.5%, which gets us to the problem, actually, the inflation that growth like that brings, especially in food prices. Never fear, though, Beijing has a solution. Grow more pigs. The government announced today it's going to invest almost $400 million in pork production and try to bring down the price of what is basically a staple food over there. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow gained 44 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ nudged up 15 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 added 4 points, a third of 1%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back on The Big Show, you think you've got pressure to get married?
You are 28?
Yes.
You don't have much time left.
Why? I have a lifetime left.
Yeah, she kind of let me have it. When a growing economy brings cultural changes, that's tomorrow on our series, The 5-Year Plan. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can be here for that. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul the Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul the Story are available now.